little something between you and me. Don't cost you nothing, this one's for free.
It's worthwhile thinking about how we teach examination skills to our GB registrars, our trainees, and also maybe then coming back to complexity, if that's okay. So,
yeah, I mean, I think
we it sounds like we need to try and define and say, look, you're doing too much of this examination. You just need to do what we do in the examination, which is just choosing to the examination, not to do the examination the way that you were taught in medical school,
yeah,
but just do the cheats. So we need to learn how to demonstrate those cheats.
Not the cheats. No, that's wrong, Keith.
It's a shortcut.
It's trying to figure out which bits of information give you
the most information.
Well, it'll help you with your decision making. So Friday, I'll be playing a 21-year-old girl who's just come back from Australia with a query DVT. All right. Now, when I discuss that case, I mean, there are certain things in the history that are important, if you're thinking about DVT. There are certain things in the examination that are important, but only one, which is calf circumference. Now, if that is the only thing from an examination point of view, usually, you can look at the legs and the veins and that sort of stuff, yeah. But from a discriminatory point of view, you need to do that, all right? Now, where everybody goes wrong, and has done for the last 15 years with that case, is that if you think about Wells' criteria, which is a great way of looking at focused data gathering, because it gives you a structure and a marking schedule, the last part of Wells' criteria, I don't know if you remember what the last question was. Is there a more likely diagnosis? All right. Now, it's almost a metaphor for my training now. When you come in and see somebody and they say, I think I've got this, is there another more likely diagnosis? That's what we test. We test that hypothesis all the time. And so what happens, and this is pertinent to your point, Keith, is that people come in and I say, I think I've got a DVT. So the first thing I think is, well, have you got a DVT? And the second thing I think is there another more likely diagnosis? So when I'm starting to take my data gathering, I need to think of other more likely diagnoses. So what happens in this case always is that I'll expose both my legs, people will measure them. There's a 4 centimeter difference in my calves because I ruptured my Achilles years ago. It's very rare for anybody to pick that up because they're not expecting it. I measure my calves and I say, 42 and 40 something, I'm going, no, this one's not measured again. Yeah, okay. And I show them the scar at the end of it, which shows why I've got a discrepancy, but they don't expect it. So they don't, because they're not thinking. And so what they do then is they've got these two legs in front of them. And like all good doctors, they think there's two legs. I need to examine these two legs. So what do? I do pulses. I'll examine the knees. I'll do sensation. I'll maybe even do the reflexes. What the hell's that got to do with DVT? Nothing. And the key question is, is there another more likely diagnosis? I could say to that 21-year-old girl, what I'm interested in is there another more likely diagnosis? And she says, well, yeah, I've been mountain biking in Australia for the last month. I've been up Mount Alice Springs, fallen off my mountain bike and different things, and I've knackered my leg type of thing. That's a more likely diagnosis. So therefore, when it comes to the examination, we don't do the final year examination. We test the calf, we stretch the calf muscle, we do the things that confirm the other more likely diagnosis. So we exclude DVT. By the end of the questioning, we know she probably hasn't got a DVT anyway if you're using Wells criteria. The examination, even if it was plus one, probably wouldn't add enough to do scans and things. But more importantly, you then need to have the examination that's actually going to give you the answer to the problem that she's got. Because what I'm going to do then is I'm going to bring in at 7 minutes. Well, I read in the magazine on the plane that it's really difficult for you guys to diagnose DVTs, and what I really need is a scan, XYZ, mega really arty. If you've done the stuff that actually proves that it's a more muscular thing in your examination, you stand a much better chance of then selling the management plan of you don't need a scan, you don't need this and that. And that case over the years has been fantastically discriminatory. Not that particular case, but if you think bad people can easily fail that case, good people can do well, but the borderline is just, it's like a battlefield. Whether people are doing full examinations, they're running out of time, they're doing D-dimers when they shouldn't, they're organizing scans when they shouldn't, they're not diagnosing the stuff that missed out on the whole sort of mountain biking thing. It's a very, very straightforward case, but it's a really good way of illustrating that what we're looking for is is the most serious diagnosis, but most of the time we're looking for other more likely diagnoses if we're stuck. So Wells criteria is really good as almost a teaching method for you guys with your trainees to say, this is what focused data gathering can look like. Look at that bottom line, other more likely diagnoses, because that makes you then think about it.
You can know, I just, Chris, it's all right if I just highlight the difference between the CSA exam and real life. So in real life, you've got your phone with you and you can actually sum up the Wells score and you can figure out what questions you're going to ask and what the answers are to those questions. You don't even have a computer that's accessible to the web when you're in the CSA exam. So you can blag a little bit and say, well, I've got a Wells questionnaire in front of me and I'm just going to ask the questions that are on there.
You could, although I'd expect you to have an idea about Wells in the exam.
Yeah, exactly. So you need to know these things.
The other thing is I know that I'm looking for somebody to think about the other more likely diagnoses. And so within the first 3 minutes of a consultation with something like that, I have an idea about whether this is going to go all right or not. Because I can tell what the mindset is. And it's a really good way of illustrating a very important point about focused data gathering. And that's where doing a good examination may be a good examination from the point of view of finals, but it's not necessarily a focused examination with a view to what we're trying to diagnose. Because when we examine lower limbs, we're not necessarily looking for potential rupture of a calf muscle, are we? See what I mean? So it just makes you think. And it's a bit like that. It's interesting this week because I've had to try and work without an oroscope because somebody's nicked mine. Can you believe it? Somebody pinched my pulse oximeter now. Somebody's nicked my oroscope. And it's really difficult to work without an oroscope. Even though it shouldn't be all to my management at all, because looking in somebody's ears isn't necessarily a sort of yes or no type of diagnostic thing. I can work without an ophthalmoscope for months.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can do with an iPhone light, but I've been trying it this week. But it does illustrate the fact of why we examine and what we're examining and what that's all about. And it goes back to my original point, which is a lot of our examination is about the smoke and mirrors of being a doctor. And that whole thing about he didn't even examine me. And your point before is, why didn't he examine me? I want to be examined. Why do you want to be examined? You know, it's a cultural thing, isn't it? Because people feel if they're examined, that things are going to be better. If I say to patients, and I often do now, I'm not going to examine you because it isn't going to change my management, then a lot of my patients will understand that and accept that. If I just don't do it and then it goes wrong, obviously that's when you get there and you didn't even examine me. And going back to your point, I think, before about trainees who come in to see patients instead of me, they're going to be much more likely to be criticised than I am. And so they really do need to examine patients because they're going to get and I saw your trainee and he didn't even examine me.
And so challenge the registrar as to why they PR'd a 25-year-old with PR bleeding. You know, what are the likely diagnoses? Why did you need to suggest that into examination to that patient? Or what are the likelihoods? How are you going to test them? What were you going to see and find?
And a good example of that would be a 2-week referral in CSA. Would you always examine, would you always PR somebody who you're going to do a 2-week referral on for altered bowel habit or bleeding?
It's the same postmenopausal bleeding. So you know, when the first 5 minutes that a lady comes in at 60 and says, I've had a PV bleed, you know what you're going to do, don't you?
Trainees feel uncomfortable about those decisions, and unless they've talked to people like us about it, then in an exam situation, they really think, oh my God, you know, I need to examine somebody. Obviously, you're not going to do a PR or a PV, and it might work its way through. But, you know, you could easily get the actors to say, well, if I'm going to hospital, do you think that's really necessary, don't you? That's how I would turn that case around, you know. And then you get some doctors to say, oh, yes, yeah, because it says on the form, have you done it? And if I haven't ticked that box, it'll get sent back. And so you can get into those scenarios. The story that I always tell is when I was finally a medical student at the RVI, when Keith Dickinson, who was a vascular surgeon there, would be on his ward rounds, and he would hit me with a ruler that he used to carry whenever I was about to examine somebody's abdomen and said, he said, I don't want you to touch that patient without you telling me what it is you're looking for and how are you going to find it. And it stayed with me, and the scars. It stayed with me over the years because actually what he was saying then is the same as what I'm saying now, except he was a little bit more violent in his approach. you know, before you lay a hand on a patient, tell me what it is that you're going to do and why you're going
to
do that.
But that's how I tell the registrars to seek consent from the patients to be examined, is tell them what you're examining and what you expect to see or not see.
Yeah.
And they've covered all the bases, haven't they?
And so if you actually do that with the patient in the consultation, say, you know, I think this might be appendicitis, so I need to pop you on the couch and sort of have a feel of your tummy, you know, and then when you've got them up there, you say, what I'm looking for is, you know, whether it gets worse when I take my hand off or whatever. So when I do it, obviously it's going to be sore, but this is what I want you to tell me about. You know, those sorts of things are not only informing patients, but also telling me as an examiner what's happening. And that's good because it makes you think about why you're doing things rather than just going, right, off you go type of thing, you know.
Let's hear it for our GP. Skills improving, risk removing, no